organization that works to increase legal access for immigrants at detention centers, both locally and around the country. There will be live stand-up sets from Adam Passy and Dan Weber, and live music by Pedro Queriega. Again, that's Bonds Over Borders on Tuesday, August 27th at 6 p.m. at The Cleaners at Ace Hotel, 403 Southwest 10th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm. Coming up next on Art Focus, Joseph Galavan interviews abstract artist Amy Bernstein. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from the Clinton Street Theater, open since 1915. Featuring independent films, parties, and community events, located at 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. Full event schedule, tickets, showtimes, and more information is available online at cstpdx.com.
Andy Whoa, whoa looks a scream, hang him on my whoa. Andy Whoa, whoa silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Galavan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Amy Bernstein. She's an artist and writer, and soon to be a student at the Ruskin School of Art in Oxford, England. Thanks for coming into KBOO, Amy.
You're welcome, Joseph. It's nice to be here.
People would know you from around town as an abstract painter. You're represented by National. And they might know your name from Port, which is the critical site run by Jeff Yarn.
Yes.
Port.net. Mm-hmm. And you've been writing there for a long time.
Yes.
But what I find particularly exciting is you are off to Oxford, to my old college, St. Edmund Hall. Well, that's where you'll be living. But the actual school is called the Ruskin School of Art, named after John. And you're going to do... Starting this fall, you're going to do a one-year MFA.
That's
right. Is that correct?
Yep.
In art. So, do you know what you're going to be doing when you get there? You're going to bring brushes? Are you going to be all books to read? What is it?
I mean, that is, I think the nature of an MFA in general, or the hope, is that you're kind of wanting to dismantle your normal practice and kind of upend your ways of thinking by introducing all kinds of different schools of thought and ways of making that kind of just throw you for a loop. So you kind of undo your habits to reform new ones. And it's kind of this pressure cooker that that most people would be really, really difficult to do without the MFA. I've been working for a long time in the studio, and I think I've come closer to that kind of rigor. But it's taken me like a decade to do what I think that MFA students do in a year or two.
Oh.
So that's really the advantage of doing an MFA. The
rigor, meaning the work of rethinking your practice?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Without, you do that on your own, like organically?
I mean, just being an artist, you try your hardest to distill whatever language you're kind of trying to form. But to have that kind of breakdown and that kind of answering to your own questions and answering to other people that are looking at your work really is not found anywhere except that environment. So it's pretty special in that way.
Yeah.
And that's the hope. I mean, if you go to a good program, that's really what you hope to get out of it.
Mm-hmm. So you'll get there and you will have a studio space somewhere.
Yes.
And you'll have your big canvases probably, and you'll paint. And then will there be critique, and then there'll be a theoretical portion. Correct?
Exactly. Yeah. The program, I mean, every MFA is pretty self-directed, but you're kind of provoked by the contemporary theory that is like the kind of conversation that surrounds contemporary work.
Mm-hmm.
So you attend these seminars and you have a weekly meeting with your tutors, and then you're with your you're kind of in the studio constantly with your cohort. Having these discussions and like kind of questioning yourself. it can be like a real kind of existential crisis, but also like a good one. So you have to be kind of like, get a very thick skin, you know, and get ready to kind of like be undone.
Yeah. And you're going to be mixed in with the undergraduates, right? These are going to be the 20-year-olds from England,
well,
mainly.
I'm not sure. Honestly, you know, I think that Oxford is a place where there is a lot of, seems to be a lot of British students, but also a lot of very, a huge international contingent as well. So mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I mean, they haven't really told me who is going to be. I mean, I think that, you know, the PhD students and the undergraduates and the MFAs are all together at the Ruskin School, very in close proximity, so that I think that kind of also is nice for conversation and discourse, really, which is mm-hmm. also a goal, I think, a rare discourse.
mm-hmm. So you'll be painting whatever you want, basically, right? Mm-hmm. They're not going to say this week we're going to study the nude.
No.
Is like, do your own thing, mm-hmm. but also go to lectures and write mm-hmm. essays mm-hmm. and take it all very seriously. And so you have 1 year.
Very seriously, yes.
1 year, and then at the end of it you'll have a master's in what?
In fine art.
Fine art.
Mm-hmm.
And what will that get you?
Well, it'll hopefully up the ante on my own kind of questions is like the main goal for me. I got the opportunity to work with Carl Berkheimer this past semester at OCAC.
Who's he?
He was the chair of the fine art graduate program at OCAC, the Oregon College of Art and Craft. And I really enjoyed the conversations that I had with the other students. It felt like a very collaborative kind of thinking process, and I really wanted that for myself as well. I wanted also the opportunity maybe to do some more teaching, so that, because I just found it incredibly invigorating and inspiring and rewarding. So hopefully I'll, you know, but the main goal for me really is to kind of like see how far I can push my own work.
Mm-hmm. So it's an intellectual endeavor, really. I mean, you're not trying to get a teaching credit or anything like that.
No.
You're going there for your art.
Yes, for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, and I think that I think you were discussing with me earlier, like how kind of a Oxford maybe is a random choice to get your graduate degree in art. But I think because it's kind of a random choice, it feels even more right for me. Uh-huh. You know?
Well, I'm sure all the KBOO listeners are on the edge of their chairs thinking, how can I game the system and get my kids into Oxford?
Yeah.
Because that's how it's done, right?
Well, now, yeah, I gamed. I'm strategic.
It seems like a long way away from here. How did you get the idea? What was the initial contact? And then how did you apply and get accepted?
Well, you know, I had a dear friend's husband had attended Oxford, and we were having a conversation one night, and I was telling him my endless question whether or not I should get my graduate degree, because, you know, I had an incredible undergraduate experience that was incredibly rigorous.
And
that was at the Rhode Island School of Design. And because of that rigor, I didn't think that I could go, if I was going to go back to school to get an MFA, I needed something that was equally as rigorous. And but I also wanted something that was going to be a different experience. I didn't want to study, I don't know, I needed something that kind of like shifted things or provoked me in a different way, whether it was going to be the setting or like the culture or the politic or like, mm-hmm. I wanted all of that kind of thing. So when he suggested that to me, he's like, he had gotten, I think, a couple different graduate degrees in maths. And he said it was just such a fantastic experience and that it was only 1 year, which I thought was also interesting and also very fast to get an MFA. Honestly, it's a pretty hard thing, I think, to undo your own habits in a year, but I'm going to try my hardest.
Mm-hmm.
His suggestion just kind of planted that seed in my mind. And once I started to research it, it just became more and more attractive to me. And so then I applied. And I have been working in the arts consistently since I graduated my undergrad, you know, my first degree. So it wasn't too difficult to find recommendations and mm-hmm. whatnot. And also, I think I probably pose a bit of an anomaly to the rest of the student body. Maybe, you know, I'm a lot older than maybe most graduate students, and I'm coming from the West Coast of the United States, and so who knows? But
what was the application like? Did you have to prove you can paint, or did you have to prove you, I don't know, write an essay or something?
Well, you both. I mean, you know, most graduate applications, you for an MFA, you submit your portfolio and a statement of purpose, which is really kind of why you, why now, why this place, convince us. Mm-hmm. So you submit all of those things, and then you also have a bunch of three different referees, references, people that are willing to vouch for you that are, in my case, not former professors, because it's been far too long to kind of, you know, mine that resource, but more so colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had just an incredible opportunity to have some very, very articulate and very intelligent colleagues that vouched for me. So I think that probably helped my case.
So they would write a little paragraph mm-hmm. about you and how you would flourish there.
Yeah.
When you said you showed your portfolio, did mm-hmm. you just like say, click on amybernsteinstudio.com?
Well, they ask you to basically create a portion of a website that is just for the Oxford portfolio.
Oh, they do?
Yes. So I just added a page to my website that was for that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes.
Oh. Is that visible?
Not right now. I just took it down, I think.
Okay.
What
did you think? Like, when you were trying to sift through your work to impress them, how did you go about it?
I think I just wanted to pose the things that I had very clear images of that were very accurate and very relevant to where I was at right mm-hmm. at that time when I was applying. And
so
I thought that was the most important thing.
When you get there, I suppose you're going to have to do a lot of self criticism, and you know, verbally you're gonna have to defend your work and explain it. So let's have a little go now.
Okay.
A little practice. You do abstracts.
Yes.
Abstract paintings, right? Acrylic on canvas.
No, oil.
Oil.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
It's okay. I think that my work, it, you know, painting is always in a funny place in the contemporary context, because comes out of such a long history and a long tradition. So it can't often or ever really, I believe, help but have to address and speak to that history in some way, despite the fact that images are ubiquitous. We make them in all different kinds of ways. They don't seem beholden to anything. But with painting, you really have to like answer to a lot. So and answer all these questions of like why you do what you do. But for me, I always think that, I mean, I honestly think that paint, especially oil paint, is the best analog recorder of moments, better than a photograph or even this sonic thing that is recording our voices right now. It can record violence or, you know, torpor or lethargy and sadness and ecstasy and all these wonderful things. And I think that it can do that very much just through the stuff that it is. And that's a kind of like contemporary, I mean, and that's a very old argument at this point, even unto itself, to have this kind of like miasmic goo that is like this spiritual stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really what I love.
Right.
So to make an image that like adheres to that possibility of speaking unto itself by all, and also at the same time using a minimal image that is compositionally uncomfortable. So it's just this imprinting stuff, you know, the same as maybe like mud or music. You know, I think that these things are very prescient. And I also think that they're very difficult for me. They're very difficult to do. They're very difficult to make something that is relevant to a time, especially with an oil painting. But at the same time, I also feel that people are sort of hungry for an analog respite, you know, in mm-hmm. the midst of all of these things that are simple, but also maybe true and small. Even mm-hmm. though I make big things, I think of them as kind of like small moments.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot about that when I'm painting. I really enjoy painting. I like the stuff of paint. I'm a very physical person.
What
I
do you wear when you're painting?
Overalls. like
what kind of shoes?
Just tennis shoes, you know.
Trash heel boots
that are covered in paint and
yeah. You get really into it.
Yeah, and I also,
because you've got a painting that's 26 feet long.
Yeah,
right?
That was
a ditch in Springfield, Oregon.
That was for a show called Unknown the Witch. Yeah, that I did last year, which was really fun. But there's also an aspect of my work which is the white surface, which is also very, very smooth. I sand it, you know, layers and layers of gesso onto that surface to make it just be incredibly smooth, so that it becomes an even more kind of apt mm-hmm. recorder. I don't want the surface to be part of the marks. So that's part of what I do and what I love, and hopefully. And, you know, the viewer is as important to me as the image. So, you know, it's like my friend Carl said to me one time, you know, like, what's a sports game without the fans? Like, you need that interaction for the work to work.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no didactic sort of dogma that I have for a viewer to like be like, I want you to see exactly this.
Mm-hmm. Are you confident in the viewer's ability to get anything out of your paintings?
Well, you know, I used to think that was a very arrogant thing that I could never claim. But after doing this for this long period of time, you know, I feel sometimes like just bowled over by the kind of testimony that so many viewers actually do give me. And I feel like sort of like a priest in like a confession booth or something, like, where I didn't even do this for you. This is you. You're seeing, in a way, yourself, mm-hmm. which I also think is fantastic.
And so are they experiencing those emotions that you talked about, like, you know, anger and things like that?
I think, yeah. I mean, I feel like, no, I haven't really heard anyone have an angry or see violence, which I feel like is in there, and like angst and all these things, but most people don't have that.
Mm-hmm.
Most people have kind of like this this elegant, like, sort of peaceful reassurance through, which is also like astonishing, but
mm-hmm.
but something that people have told me before, so also just very humbling and interesting.
And you said you composed to make things feel uncomfortable,
but
the way you design things.
Well, I think the uncomfortableness doesn't actually serve to be uncomfortable, but it serves to be more engaging and perhaps like more unusual, so that your attention would be grabbed, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, that's a huge claim too, I think, but.
Yeah,
that would be the goal.
Are you kicking against some kind of staid kind of language of visual
yeah.
language that's out there in the world?
For sure,
commercial visual language.
I mean, not even commercial, but just like rote. Yes, and even in an app, there are rote marks. You know.
Oh yeah.
So many, and
so you're trying to do things with your hands that are unusual.
Yes. Yeah, and to. But you see the rote things happen all the time, because that's just the way we've been. They just come into you and you mm-hmm. make them, and when you're not paying attention, especially.
Really?
Yeah, you really have to pay attention to find the things that are like a unique punctuation, you know, that you're kind of developing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think of it that way. Yeah.
Maybe have you read The War Against Cliché? It's a Martin Amis collection of essays.
No, but I would like to.
It's all about it's self-evident. You know, he can't stand clichés and corny journalism, and he's trying to write with a very clear eye on what he really sees.
Well, I think it is the same thing. You know, with writing is like, you know, you juxtapose. I mean, especially in the English language, at least. You juxtapose certain words to get closer to a truth, you know, that is even about maybe a mundane thing. But when you describe something that is very mundane in a very true way, it becomes somehow like clear and meaningful.
Mm-hmm. As a critic, you'd go out, you'd pick shows, you know, and say, I'll do this one and do it for Port.
Mm-hmm.
What was your feeling as a critic and a painter? You know, were you sort of trying to keep the two separate? Like, or did you use your response to a painting as your criticism?
Yeah, I mean, I never think of myself as a, like, I never thought of criticism or writing or painting to be part of any sort of different practices. I feel like they're all the same, and I feel like they're necessary and integral and to each other. For me, my criticism, I always thought of being kind of more of a civic duty, honestly.
What, being a critic?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So somebody's got to go out and bring attention to
yes,
this work.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, definitely.
I know how you feel.
Yeah, because, you know, you're not doing it for really any other reason but that. And the discourse, I think, is also part of a civic duty and a social responsibility that we have, conversation. I think that that's, you know, I think that's a political thing. I think it's a cultural thing, and I think it's very important. It's why the humanities and the arts are important. It's the way of thinking and seeing and speaking to things that are not speaking with words and that are need to be seen and need to be kind of parsed and need to be addressed. And hopefully that, and addressing that, that addressing is somewhat artistic in itself. And that makes it interesting mm-hmm. enough as well for someone to read.
Yeah.
So
not turgid academic prose.
No. No, thank you.
Talking of which, in Oxford.
Yeah, exactly. Ha-ha.
You're going to be asked to read all the latest mm-hmm. critical theory. Mm-hmm. Have you kept up on that since Rhode Island?
God, no. But I do enjoy it, I have to say. And being working with Carl at OCAC this past semester... I really did get to, sharpen my chops a little mm-hmm. bit on the theory, which was really fun.
What's new? Is everyone now communist again?
I think it's more like,
is everyone a psychoanalyst this year?
No, I think they're more into like cyber politics and redefining mediums and all kinds of very interesting stuff.
Well, that's good. At least you can relate to that, right?
Oh,
we all touch those things every day.
Exactly, exactly.
We're not all in psychoanalysis. That was the thing of some of the academic stuff. It was hard to access. So you go in there with an open mind about your critical life too. Like you said, you want to rebuild your whole artistic practice. What mm-hmm. about your thinking and writing life?
You mean in terms of do I want to rebuild that as well? Or yes, I mean I want to take it in all. I want it all.
I want to take it all makeover. In.
Yeah, I am very excited about that. You know, you get tired of your own self. I don't want my own ideas to only. I want to be influenced by all these incredible thinkers and writers and people that have dedicated their lives to this work, and I think it's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can't wait to be influenced by these incredible minds and creative weirdos. It's like those are my people.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean that's the campus is a setting in any universities like that. It forces everyone together and to do things that, or listen to things they wouldn't normally listen to. And it's the thing about Oxford, right? It's a university, but it's 30 odd different little colleges. So each college has its own building and its own place to eat, its own bar. They duplicate everything, chemistry professors. And so you can have a small kind of focused life there with access to everyone. You can be at dinner and sit by a mathematician, or a professor of chemistry, and they're happy to talk. And there's also lots of social stuff going on. They're always having like little parties,
That's the thing I didn't understand and was very hard for me to explain to other American friends what a college was, because here mm-hmm. college is just the university. There's no separation. So, but there a college is more like a kind of socializing entity.
Yeah, I mean, each one has its own, academics and its own place to sleep. The students, usually the first years anyway, if they have room. And then it's a little social unit. And then everyone goes out to get their lectures together at a big place. Like all the English students go to the big library lecture hall thing for English.
Okay.
So that's where you meet all your kind of peers. And then you go back to college where there's probably 10 of you doing English. So I don't know how it is in art. I mean, I think you might be the only art student
probably
at St. Edmund Hall. But there'll be, I don't know, 50 other graduate students that you'll see every day when you go to the Ruskin.
I'm so excited.
And I think the idea is everywhere you go, you're just surrounded by interesting people, and you just, it's very stimulating.
I cannot wait.
The other good thing about being there is there's a bus like goes from outside the building where you're going to be. It goes straight to London.
Oh my gosh.
In an hour. So
oh my gosh.
You can hit like all the great English museums, the London museums. What are you going to do? How are you going to balance your time? Because the good thing about Oxford is it's pretty quiet. It's a small town. It gets dark at like 4 o'clock.
Oh, wow.
And it's very good for working.
Mm-hmm.
But how are you going to balance that introverted life of the painter or the student with this, you know, chance to see all this great art?
That's going to be very difficult for me. I'm not very good at balancing anything in life. So, I mean, I think I'm just going to try to... I mean, I'll have to put myself on some sort of schedule. I have no idea. I mean, I have a tendency in a scholastic environment to just put my head down and not really do anything else but work. Mm-hmm. So I have to take advantage of London. I want to, I mean, the Tate is right there. I can't even believe it. I'm going to lose my mind. I mean, I don't know.
There's two Tates.
I know. I mean, I don't have a good answer to that question. I'm going to think about it.
Right.
Very soon.
You going to get a car?
No.
Right.
No. I can't. I love being in a place where public transit is, you know, efficient and, you know, works.
Yeah.
I'll probably get a bike.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good idea. There's probably a group that goes to London just to look at art. You know, it's kind of like Meetup, but when I was there, there wasn't Meetup. There was like bulletin boards.
Oh, yeah.
People would plan things, you know.
Yeah.
So you could just tag along with that rather than doing everything on your own.
Right, right. I bet, yeah, I'm sure. I think that's, I mean, I'm not sure. I have no idea what to expect.
Mm-hmm. Great. So when you get back, you'll have a degree. You think it'll get you anything like, you know, teaching work or?
I hope so. I mean, I think that it would be really wonderful to be able to share all the things that I've learned there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's really, at this point, getting that experience with OCAC, what you realize is that you're like, oh, I mean, in a contemporary art setting, it's not always so much like I have this scholar to tell you about or this book to tell you about, which is part of it for sure. But really in a contemporary art setting, what you can do for someone else is like tell them how to ride this ride. And what the ride is basically how to ask questions about what's in front of you to kind of give you some insight into what the artist might be thinking or how it plays into the greater discussion. And that's a really fun thing to say that I can do at this point in my career, in my art life, is that I know how to ride this ride. So, yeah.
That's really well put. When you're there, you're obviously going to paint and probably paint big.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to do at the end of the year when you got like 30 canvases all rolled up?
Well, hopefully all my new friends in London will need some art to decorate their walls.
Okay, so your Instagram is?
Paintstein.
Paintstein. Yeah. Everyone should look at it. And especially over the next year.
Yes.
Because we all want to follow along, and please come back. When you're done with Oxford. My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Amy Bernstein. She's an artist and writer and is off in October to study at the Ruskin School of Art at Oxford University. Thank you so much for coming into KBOO, Amy.
Oh, my pleasure, Joseph. Thank you.
Andy Warhol looks a scream, and him on my wall. stream, can't tell them apart at all.
Hello, KBOO members. Thank you for being a part of our amazing community. Please join us this year at Mike to the People, our annual election meeting. Do you want to help steer KBOO in a positive direction this fall? Plan on attending the annual election meeting, Mike to the People, September 14th from noon to 3 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater and make your voice heard. Cast your vote by 1 p.m. at the event and enjoy refreshments and live entertainment with local musicians West Coast Black Bear and Izzy BM. Hear a report back from your board of directors and get to know this year's candidates. Record your fondest memories of KBOO in a minute or less at the Mic to the People booth. This is an all-ages and disability-affirmative event. Again, that's the annual election meeting, Mic to the People, Saturday, September 14th from noon to 3 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, featuring West Coast Black Bear and Izzy BM. More information can be found at kboo.fm/meeting2019. Remember, your voice matters.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Community Advisory Board will meet Tuesday, August 27th at 6 p.m.